is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, we got a surprise on GDP on Friday. Experts thought we would be growing at 1%. Instead, we got a print of 3.2%. Stock markets hitting records all across the board, surpassing those highs reached last October. What's heading in the future? Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Jonathan Krinsky will be joining me in the first hour. He sees a sort of a market consolidation here. He's very, very bullish on energy stocks, and he sees some potential problems. You'll want to listen to what he has to say. And Mark Chandler will be talking about the breakout of the dollar on this Friday. What impact will that have on corporate profits, because 40% of S&P companies get their profits from overseas. And of course, Mark right now, well, he says he's a little cautious and scared. And Chris Sheridan will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And coming up in Hour 2, the big picture, Jim Poplava and I discussed the price of oil and gasoline. This week, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced that the waivers granted last November relating to Iranian oil would not be extended beyond May 2nd. Could higher oil prices derail the chances for a second-half recovery that economists are hoping for? Also in Hour 2, politics is causing healthcare to tank and gas prices to break the bank. We discuss why and what investors should do in Hour 2, the big picture.
The S&P 500 and NASDAQ closed at record highs this week after a surprisingly positive 3.2% GDP number for the first quarter released on Friday. This is actually the first time in 4 years that we've seen first quarter GDP top 3%, and since most estimates were closer to 2, at least on the surface, it looks like the economy is on a pretty solid footing and for the moment is helping to offset fears over a slowing global and U.S. economy. Before we look at some of the finer details on the GDP print, however, for the indices this week, the S&P 500 closed at 2,939, the tech-heavy NASDAQ ended at 8,146, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at 26,543, which is still 1.5% below its all-time high. But again, both the S&P 500 and NASDAQ are now at record highs. Now, on the Q1 GDP number, looking under the hood, some, like Mark Chandler, who will be on the show a little bit later, are saying this number was artificially boosted by a temporary build in inventories and a smaller trade deficit. The Trump administration is clearly on the side of this being sustainable and is forecasting that 2019 will continue to be a good year for the economy. But Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs have now dragged their estimates lower for this quarter, the second quarter, Q2, with a forecast of 1.1% by Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs slightly higher at just over 2%. So economic data watchers are basically saying, yes, this was a good number for Q1 GDP, but most of the gain was temporary and will likely offset growth for this quarter, for the second quarter. The more pessimistic observers are saying that when you look at the underlying trend of the real economy, though, consumption, investment, and not just the one-off factors that we saw with inventories or trade factors, it looks like the economy is slowing and that the Fed will likely remain on pause for this reason. When it comes to the global economy, as we've discussed on Financial Sense News Hour many times, South Korea is widely seen as an important bellwether since they are a major exporter to countries all over the world. On that front, Peter Buchvar pointed out today that the South Korean economy contracted unexpectedly in Q1 instead of rising as expected. Now, exports make up almost 50% of the South Korean economy, and they reported exports fell 8.7% year over year in the first 20 days of April. That's the fourth month in a row of declines, he writes. Semiconductor shipments also fell, which are considered a leading indicator as well. They plunged by 25% year over year, so this is giving some observers caution when it comes to hopes that we are seeing quote-unquote green shoots or a rebound in the global economic data. Following 7 consecutive weeks of gains, crude prices also plunged around 3% on Friday to $63.30 after Trump said he told OPEC to bring prices down. Trump knows that higher oil and gas prices mean higher inflation, more Fed rate hikes, less consumer spending, and a weaker economy. Thus, Trump told reporters en route to an NRA event in Indianapolis that gasoline prices are coming down. I called up OPEC and I said, you've got to bring them down. You've got to bring them down. And gasoline's coming down. So that's what Trump told reporters this Friday. And we have seen a nearly 3% decline in oil prices now. We'll have to see if that is sustained. The national average for gas prices right now is just under $3. And in California, they're at $4. So that is certainly eating into consumers' wallets. And this is something that we'll be picking up more in the big picture on our next show. So you'll definitely want to hear what Chris Prytower and Jim Poplava have to say on that. And then lastly, on FS Insider this week, Lauren Baker at ITR Economics, she explained how they think the risk of an actual risk of a recession has been pushed off here in the U.S. until 2022. That's based on their leading economic indicators that they follow. That said, they are sticking to their forecast of a Great Depression around the 2030 timeframe. So you'll definitely want to hear what she had to say on Tuesday. We also interviewed Jordan Frith about his new must-read book, A Billion Little Pieces, RFID and Infrastructures of Identification. We talked about everything from the different types of RFID chips, how they work, how they're connected to the Internet of Things, blockchain, the billions of objects that are now embedded within them, fears over mass surveillance, and the so-called Mark of the Beast. So lots of interesting topics that we covered in that interview, two parts that we broke it into on FS Insider this week. If you're not already a subscriber to FS Insider, all you need to do is just go to financialsense.com and click subscribe to gain access to those shows that air 3 days a week, every week for you listeners out there.
Oh, I want to stay right here, chilling with my friends for another year. I would walk away from the spotlight.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
I like to make the comparison that with things like our debt, we know the problem is getting worse and worse, but up till this point, it hasn't really caused any major problems, no major economic contractions or something like that. But eventually, we just won't be able to kick the can down the road any longer. So when we talk about things like the debt, like these imbalances that are building across our government and across our economy, if we just look at where things are today, current transfer payments, just the Social Security, you know, healthcare spending, these required transfer payments are actually larger in dollar volume than our current tax receipts.
Everyone wants to retire well. That's not as easy as it sounds. You need to make the right investment choices, decide when to take Social Security, plan for taxes on your retirement income, and create a legacy for your family. To retire well, you need a roadmap to help you get there. Let Financial Sense Wealth Management help you navigate your way to retirement. We provide comprehensive, thoughtful, and personal retirement planning. Call Financial Sense Wealth Management now at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Start your journey to retiring well today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, after hitting all-time record highs, stocks are pulling back at the moment. Is this just a pause that refreshes, or maybe are we about to repeat what happened last year? Let's find out. Joining me on the program is Jonathan Krinsky from Baycrest Partners. Jonathan, let's talk about where we are right now this week. We took out records in most of the major indexes, but as you and I are speaking this Thursday, we're seeing markets pull back. Let's begin with the markets and your take there.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Good to be here. So I think, you know, what's notable, as you said, we are back near the 2018 highs for a lot of the indices. It would certainly be expected that we see some sort of pause when you first retest those highs. You know, whether or not that means a time consolidation or sideways price action or a pullback remains to be seen. But I think you could also make the case that we could get a slightly new high, just as we did in September, where we marginally exceeded the January 2018 highs. In September of 2018, you took out those highs, and then you saw the more meaningful pullback. You know, I think at this point, playing for a repeat of what we saw in the fourth quarter is probably not the most likely scenario. You know, clearly we were a bit too cautious coming off the December low, and we still think there's certainly some risks out there. But you know, clearly the sustainability and unrelenting nature of the rally off the lows suggests that you know, we're probably not necessarily going to see a repeat of what we saw in the fourth quarter.
Well, certainly, Jonathan, if we look at the way this is playing out, last year when stocks were rising, we had two other areas that were rising. We saw rising interest rates with the 10-year yield getting up to almost 3.25%. And interest rates were rising along with rising oil prices. If you look at where we are now, we're higher on the price of oil than where we were last time at this year. But unlike last year, interest rates are not rising along with oil prices. So what does that tell you?
We tend not to make too much of intermarket correlations because they often come and go. And what I mean by that is there are periods when stocks and bonds rise together, fall together. There's periods where stocks go up, bonds go down, and vice versa. And the same with oil. So I don't think I would put too much into that. You know, our interest rates tend to be anchored because global rates are also quite low. Obviously, we know about Japan and European yields just remain at pretty depressed levels. So I think until something changes overseas, it's unlikely that we see a meaningful move higher in our interest rates. As far as crude oil, you know, it's been an impressive run. I think something like 60% off the December lows. And, you know, I think our sense is that we probably are due for some consolidation in WTI crude in the 65, maybe even it gets up to 70. But I think that's kind of the upside range we're looking at. But what is notable, and the correlation tend to be higher, is with crude and energy stocks. Of course, that makes much more sense. But over the last couple of months, while crude oil has moved higher, energy stocks have actually lagged quite a bit. So, you know, we think there is the potential for some further catch up in the energy stocks relative to the commodity. And we've seen a little bit of that of late. We also had some M&A activity with Anadarko Petroleum getting a bid from Chevron and Occidental. So there's definitely some interesting things going on in the energy sector, but I wouldn't read too much into crude oil versus the S&P, again, just because the correlations tend to come and go there.
I want to talk specifically now as we take a look at the S&P sectors. Jonathan, you have consumer discretionary breaking out to very, very strong record levels. But at the same time, you also have things like consumer staples that are also doing well. Normally, you don't see those two doing well at the same time, but it looks like just about everything's going up.
Yeah, there are certainly some mixed signals and cross currents out there, and that's to your point, that's right. And I think what's going on, though, is because interest rates are so low, we're seeing, and presumably that means that global growth is not very strong. We're seeing kind of a situation where some of the names with high growth are getting bid. So that's a lot of your tech, internet, software plays. Because if there's no growth out there, investors are looking for growth within individual stocks. And then conversely, you're also seeing some of the bond-like proxies that are also doing well because, again, interest rates are so low. So people are looking for yield because you can't get it in the bond market. So it's kind of an interesting setup where we're seeing high growth names do well, but also the names that you wouldn't expect perhaps just because interest rates are so low.
So do you think that explains what we're seeing in REITs, utilities, and consumer staples is just a search for yield?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a search for yield. It's a bond-like play. Bonds are strong, so those sectors tend to do well. You know, and it's a very difficult message when you look at the intermarket underpinnings, just because we're getting so many mixed signals, both, you know, in interest rates and commodities, currencies, and then the sectors as well. It's something that you don't always see it. Things act like this.
Yeah, I was just going to comment on that, because if you take a look at interest rates, you take a look at the dollar, you take a look at commodities, if you look at the typical long-term intermarket relationships, they seem to be out of whack right now.
Yeah, that's certainly the case. And you could say a lot of that's changed since the financial crisis, right? That a lot of the intermarket analysis that we were so used to, or that the textbooks tell you, have kind of been thrown out of whack since the 09 lows and since, you know, the Fed has become such an important part of the market. So we'll see if things go back a little bit to normal. You know, I think the other thing that we've been watching are the small caps, right? So you have S&P, NASDAQ at new highs. Well, the small caps are still, I think, about 8% below their 52-week highs, which is pretty unusual. We actually saw some other people commenting that has only happened a couple of times. I think most notably was March of 2000, which obviously was not a good signal. So I think there's basically two ways to look at this, right? And the bull scenario is that small caps have been lagging, but they've consolidated well. They're kind of putting in a base, and that's the catch-up trade. And you know, presumably, if the market is going to go higher from here, you would think that small caps would have to play some catch-up, being still 8% below their lows. The bear case is that they're lagging for a reason. Oftentimes, at market tops, you see secondary or small cap stocks tend to roll over first or underperform, as investors hide in the perceived safety of larger cap names. And, you know, if you look back historically, that's often the case at tops where the small caps roll over and then finally the large caps roll over. We certainly saw that in the fall of last year even. So it's kind of, I don't think the move is to make a bet either way at this point. I think, you know, you'll kind of know if the small caps are starting to play catch up, if they kind of break out. If we're looking at the IWM, I think getting some closes above 160 would certainly put some weight of the evidence into that case. But right now, I think it's just a wait and see game to see which way we go here in the small caps.
I want to talk about another issue. We're entering a presidential election cycle, so obviously the markets are following the candidates and their programs. The markets are getting nervous with Bernie Sanders rising in the polls. As a result, you've seen the healthcare sector start to break down. I don't care if it's the insurers or it's the drug companies. What's your take on healthcare now? Because it's the one sector that's breaking down, it looks like.
Yeah, so it's pretty remarkable. It was last year's best performing sector and this year's worst. And we actually got a bit cautious several weeks ago when the relative performance of healthcare kind of started to break down and break some trend lines and some support lines. And usually there's, you know, that relative strength is a leading indicator for the absolute performance, right? So, you know, that was certainly a warning sign. I think now it's kind of in a no man's land because a lot of the names are very oversold, possibly on some support. So, you know, you probably see a bounce in healthcare. I think it's probably actually underway right now. But then, you know, if you get back, if you recover what you just lost, then it's going to be back to a difficult level for a lot of these names. And as you said, the news cycle, political rhetoric, whatever you want to say, is certainly not going away. So, yeah, I think it's a sector that's going to be in some, even if it's not in trouble in absolute terms, I don't see it outperforming the market in the near term.
Let's talk about technology and separate that from, let's say, hardware, software, and I guess you would have to take a look at some of the social media stocks.
Yeah, so if we think of technology broadly, it's clearly the dominant sector. It's the biggest weight in the S&P. It contains the biggest names, Apple, Microsoft, Google, Facebook, et cetera. So until and unless technology rolls over, it's unlikely that the market's going to roll over. And ultimately, that's what we saw in the fourth quarter, is you finally got some of the big heavyweight names starting to roll over. We haven't really seen that yet. And in fact, you know, Microsoft's at a new high today. Apple's holding in well. Facebook almost back to its highs. So, you know, they're still strong. I think what stands out to us is when we look at the industry group software. Software was a very big outperformer last year, and it actually continues to be. It's at new relative highs to the S&P as we speak. But if we look back historically in the software sector, and we go back to 1990, the average drawdown, meaning the high point of the year to the low point of any given calendar year, the average drawdown since 1990 has been 21.4%, median 18.6%. So, you know, that's just the average and median, meaning there's been years when the drawdowns have been 30, 40% for the group. The smallest drawdown we've seen for the sector was in 2017, which had almost no volatility, and that was a 5% drawdown from the highs. So that's the backdrop. And this year, the biggest drawdown from the highs we've seen in the software group is only about 3.8%. And that was January 3rd. That was 3 days into the year. So really, what that tells you is we've had no meaningful pullback in the software sector whatsoever this year. And we're coming in on third of the way through the year. So that's pretty remarkable. So basically, our takeaway there is that, yes, it's a strong group. It's least, you know, one of the strongest areas of the market out there. But even the strongest groups have, you know, eventually succumb. And even if the secular trend for software is intact, which in all likelihood it probably is, there will be a shakeout this year. It would be unprecedented to just see this type of uptrend throughout the entire year. So, you know, that's kind of what we're focused on. You know, there's areas that have been showing relative weakness. That was healthcare. Software's at the other end of the spectrum where it's literally priced to perfection. And, you know, I think the risk there is that you see a bit of a hiccup as you head throughout the year.
Let's talk about some of the other markets. And you've highlighted, you know, if you compare the world indices back out the U.S. markets, they aren't looking as good. And let's talk about Europe and Asia for a moment. In comparison to the U.S., it seems like there's a lot more value in possibilities to the upside.
Yeah, Europe's very interesting. It's been kind of the value trade or the catch-up trade for years now, and it just hasn't played out. But what stands out to us, if we look at something like the Eurostoxx 600, broad-based measure of European stocks, it's back up to kind of this 390, 400 level. And what's remarkable is that's the level we were at in 2000. So 19 years ago, we've made zero net progress in Europe on a broad-based basis. And if you go back to 2013 on the S&P, we were at the same level we were in 2000. So in 2013, the S&P had a secular bull market breakout, right? So it took out peaks from 2000, 2007. I think that was around the 1575 level in the S&P, and we're almost at 3000. So, you know, nearly a double from the breakout. And now we go to Europe and we're in a similar situation where you're back up to those prior highs, but you're now 19 years in the making. The old phrase, bigger the base, the higher in space, comes to mind here. And this isn't a call for the next 2 weeks or even 2 months, but, you know, I think if you're taking a longer term view of something and you're looking at the next 2, 3, 5 years, the presumption would be that Europe does finally break this massive secular base resistance. And, you know, maybe that coincides finally with some outperformance to the U.S., something that, you know, people have been looking for, but really just we've had no evidence that Europe is going to outperform for quite some time. So again, we're still not there on the relative outperformance, meaning it's very difficult to make the case that Europe's going to outperform until we see that breakout above secular resistance. So definitely we'll be very keenly watching Europe in the coming months.
And finally, let's talk about commodities. Specifically, I'd like to look at and discuss gold, oil, and the relationship with the dollar.
Yes, so both obviously have correlation to the dollar. I would say, in my experience, gold more so, but let's talk about them absolutely first. So gold had a nice move in the fourth quarter, and then in the first quarter of this year, moved from 1150 or so, 1160 all the way up to 1350. Looked like it may be able to break out, but that didn't happen. So now we're, you know, hovering in this 1260 to 1280 range. I think it's important to note gold is still above a rising 200-day moving average, which is down around 1250. So if you're using a level to kind of trade against or as a stop, I think, you know, that would be a good one. And again, that moving average is now rising, so it's going to continue to move up. So you could kind of use that as a trailing stop. The other thing that, as we talk about gold and the relationship to the dollar, certainly we've had this move down in gold, but that's coincided with a move up in the dollar. If we were to look at gold in other currency terms, such as the euro or the Australian dollar, you know, obviously it's acting much better and it's kind of sitting near recent highs. So if we were to, you know, we actually do think the dollar continues to move higher. So, you know, that's not part of our gold call, but if that were to reverse and dollar were to come in, then that would certainly potentially help gold push back up towards that 1300 level. But ultimately, you really need to get above kind of 1375 and then 1400 to really think that gold is resuming any sort of secular uptrend right now. So right now it's still kind of in a waiting game, but I think as long as it holds above that 1250 level, it's okay. And again, it's impressive that it's not totally broken down given the rally in the dollar.
So given where we are, we've just seen recent highs in all the indexes. As you and I are speaking, they're pulling back. As an investor, Jonathan, what would you be doing here?
I think it's very stock specific, sector specific right now. You know, I think the energy stocks offer probably the most compelling upside from our view, just given that they've lagged, but that crude oil has moved up and we're starting to see maybe a little M&A in the space. So I think some of the energy ETFs look compelling. You know, I think if you've been lucky enough to be long software, I would be, you know, at least very watching it very closely. Again, it continues to act well, but I think as we enter the back half of the year, the odds that some sort of negative reaction or negative surprises begin to come out, just given, again, we have 30 years of data tells us that this type of drawdown would be almost unprecedented. So just be a little cautious there. And I think Europe is certainly in focus. I think I would be putting on some sort of small position, probably hedged currency terms. There's an ETF, HEDJ, which is gives you exposure to Europe, but hedging out the euro currency. I think that's certainly a compelling long idea at this point.
All right, Jonathan, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do that?
Well, we are an institutional broker-dealer, so if we have any institutional listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I can be reached at Baycrest Partners. And I'm also on Twitter, Jay Krinsky, PGA.
All right. Jonathan, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. Have yourself a great weekend.
Thank you too, Jim.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
All objects are going to have unique histories that they'll be able to transmit to people. And it will be all about data, and you will be able to interact with objects on previously unprecedented levels. And they'll have stories that you'll be able to follow their complete journey through a supply chain and things like that. RFID tags are one of the first steps on that journey because they collect much more fine-grained data about an object's movement through a supply chain. And possibly most importantly, as I talk about, is with NFC working through smartphones, then at least on some level, people are able to embed information into those tags that are able to be scanned by people so that they can learn new things about products, like where that unique product was made, maybe the distribution centers it passed through, its vintage if it's a bottle of wine. And that's a shift that is just starting to happen, but may potentially really change the way that we interact with objects as end users and consumers.
After being in a narrow trading range for 3 or 4 months, we have the U.S. dollar breaking out, even though the Fed has gone dovish. What is going to drive the dollar higher, and how high will it go? Joining us on the program is Mark Chandler. He's a managing director with Bannockburn Global Forex. And Mark, let's begin with the U.S. dollar. As the Fed went soft at the beginning of the year, a lot of people thought the dollar would correct. It did for a short period of time, but on the day you and I are speaking this Friday, it's breaking out. What's going on here?
Yeah, I think it's a good question because I think a lot of people didn't expect it, especially with, as you say, with the Fed's pivot. I think I would sum up what's driving the dollar with one word: divergence. And you know, we just had this incredible U.S. GDP number above 3% for Q1, and what we're going to get is what we got earlier today, Friday, was the Japanese reported industrial output fell 0.9%. Caught the market by surprise. And this comes a day after South Korea reported unexpected contraction in first quarter GDP. Next week, the Eurozone is going to report GDP, their own GDP. And we're looking at something like about a little bit more than 1% at an annualized pace. So again, the U.S. economy proved itself resilient. And I fully accept that About half of the growth in Q1 in the U.S. was inventories and trade. But the underlying firmness still seems there, and the momentum is there. One of the weaknesses was consumption. But we've seen in the more recent retail sales data, for example, it surprised us to the upside, just as Eurozone continues to disappoint.
You know, Mark, that was one thing that took the markets by surprise on Friday, because you had, for example, in the first 6 weeks of the year, you had the government shutdown. You also, as you mentioned, retail sales were weak. Housing was weak. It looked economically, everybody was talking about a print in the 1% level. Instead, we got 3%.
It's an incredible, I think it speaks partly to the resilience of the U.S. And even though we might have to pay the price, I mean, the inventory growth will have to be drawn down at some point. But I think that what really stands out, I think, is despite what it might look like, I guess maybe like underneath the hood, people in the United States griping about politics or divisiveness or whatever. But when you look at other countries, the U.S. still like shines.
You know, Mark, speaking of other countries, I want to talk about bonds, because if we look at U.S. Treasuries, they pulled back a little bit. We have the 10-year at 2.5%. But if you look at where they are in Germany, German bonds actually have a negative, almost 2 basis points. In the U.K., interest rates are a little over 1%. In Japan, they're negative by 5 basis points. So, I mean, you know, our yields are still one of the highest yields in any of the developed countries.
Yeah, I think that like people look at the bonds in the U.S. and they say, many economists will say, well, what is the bond market telling us about the U.S. economy? And sometimes the way we phrase our question tells us the kind of answer we're going to get. So I sort of think that what's driving down U.S. rates is not so much what's happening here in the U.S., but it's really by contrast, what people can get money overseas. And I think that it's not so much that the higher rates is attracting investment into the U.S., foreigners buying treasuries or something like that, but keeping our money more at home. And I think that becomes the key. We American households, American institutions, we are funding the U.S. budget deficit, not relying so much on foreigners.
You know, that's interesting because, you know, the Japanese run large budget deficits, but it's internally financed by its own citizens. And so basically you're saying right now that's what the U.S. is doing, whether it's money managers or individuals. I mean, why would you want to invest overseas when the interest rates are far lower and in many cases negative?
Not just the interest rates. Think about like what the U.S. stock market has done this year. So the U.S., the S&P 500 is up almost 17%. The Japanese Nikkei is up about 11%. Some of the European stocks have been able to keep up with us, with the U.S., but not all of them, not all the countries. And I think that the attractiveness of, you think about these, what's like the cutting edge industries, things like Amazon and Google and Twitter, Facebook. I mean, these are the commanding heights of the new economy, and they're in the U.S. And you think about the European banks that sell. The European banks trade for something like 0.5 of book value, half of book value, while U.S. banks typically trade for a little bit more than book value. And I think that it's not just high interest rates, stock outperformance, but U.S. corporates tend to do a bit better.
As you look around the globe, once again, we have the best looking house in a global neighborhood. Japanese economic growth looks like it's weakening. You've got South Korea weakening, China's economy slowing down, and it looks like Europe's economy is barely staying above water. So I guess when you're looking globally, where else do you invest but here in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think that you have to be really careful at these kind of points, because you don't always get paid for the extra risk you're taking. I think that's what I think a lot of challenges in emerging markets, where emerging markets thought to be more volatile, more risky, and therefore people typically want to get a premium. But these days, you don't really get as much of a premium in some of these markets, where U.S. interest rates could be strong, could be higher, and the U.S. stock market could be outperforming. And the problems seem idiosyncratic, whether it's Turkey or Argentina. But as the dollar gets stronger, a lot of these countries have borrowed dollars. It becomes more expensive to pay them back, even if the Fed stays on hold.
When you take a look at the Fed's pivot this year, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this. If we take a look at the third and fourth quarter, the economy started to slow down. The Fed was very hawkish. Oil prices were rising along with bond yields. And then, of course, the president granted waivers on oil. Oil tumbled. The Fed gave very hawkish statements on whether it was QT or where they were going in interest rates. And all of a sudden, the Fed does this pivot. But Mark, we just got a 3.2% GDP print. Do you think the Fed st- stays on pause for the entire year. And as the markets, the futures market, are saying by the end of the year, the Fed could possibly be lowering interest rates. Do you agree with that assessment?
I agree that that's what the market is saying. I mean, I watched the January 2020 Fed funds futures contract, because I sort of think that's going to be a indicator of where people think Fed funds will finish this year. And right now, it's implying 2.17%.
Wow.
And as you know, the Fed funds target right now is 240. And so the markets, I look at that and say the market's still pricing in a rate cut this year. And, you know, I was one of the guys who thought that the Fed really would raise rates this year. And I'm kind of reluctant to give that up completely. I'll tell you that I see on a consumer price level, not the CPI basket that the government reports, but consumer prices that we're paying at the store. When you listen to these corporate earnings that we're getting for consumer goods, many of them are talking about raising prices. I see oil prices have gone, we're at about $67 or $65, $66 a barrel. I've been looking for $67 since we finished like a head and shoulders pattern earlier this year, combined with the macros. And I sort of think that when the Business Week and these popular magazines begin saying that inflation is dead forever and that capitalism has somehow killed inflation, I think that's just about the time when it comes back and bites us.
You know, it's interesting because that was the cover on Business Week. Basically, it reminded me, Mark, of their front cover, the stock market is dead. What was it, 1980, just before it took off for almost two decades? And the cover is inflation dead and capitalism killed it, or automation or globalization, whatever they want to call it. But, you know, I'm looking here in California where gas prices are heading to nearly $5. And we've got oil in the mid-60s. You had Brent rising almost to $80. I can't help but believe if that's the trend and it continues over the next 3 or 4 months, we're not going to see this reflected in consumer prices much in the same way we did last year.
Yeah, I think that's the thing people miss, is that the CPI is really just a basket of goods and there's a certain weightings to it. But it does not necessarily like match your household's basket of goods that they buy, and it doesn't really match the prices that you might be paying. And so I think Americans are experiencing more inflation, and I think that you're right that this is, I suspect, a trend here for a little bit longer. But what's interesting is when you look at the basket, though, for example, one of the things that weighed on the basket previously was the cut in mobile phone services. And this is what's going to happen this is what's happening in Japan as well. The Japanese are beginning to give free education to toddlers. And that's going to also drag down the CPI. But that's just a measure of the basket. So I'm concerned that the two things I think that people have blinders on that leave us vulnerable to them is, one is inflation. Secondly, I think, as you say, with the Fed's pivot, here we are with the stock market making new highs, and corporate people are revising down their corporate earnings outlook. So I'm concerned that in my work, what I sort of see, I know that the common sort of like urban legend, if you will, and the Federal Reserve fosters it. People like Janet Yellen saying the Fed is a murderer. The Fed kills. The Fed kills business cycles. But in my career, it's not the case. The great financial crisis wasn't caused by too tight a Fed policy. The tech bubble wasn't caused by too tight a Fed policy. The savings and loan crisis, those are the last three economic downturns. That for me, it leaves us vulnerable to what really hurts us, and that's financial instability.
And in your opinion, what would cause that financial instability? Because we do know, Mark, there is a large amount of debt issuance. We look at the corporate bond market, one-third is junk, one-third is triple B, and maybe one-third is quality. So if the economy was to weaken and credit spreads widen, and let's say a lot of this short-term debt doesn't get rolled over, could that be the area or epicenter of financial instability? In other words, if we were to have financial instability, where would it come out of?
Yeah, I mean, it's like what you have in California, where you have a drought. It doesn't rain for a long time. And you're not sure, you know that you're vulnerable to a fire, but you're just not sure what's going to be the spark, where is it going to be? And I think in some ways it's true about the financial conditions to get to this kind of point where they think the Federal Reserve is on hold. The Federal Reserve is dovish. White House is still calling for a 50 basis point interest rate cut, a resumption of QE. And so, when early in my career, I remember when Gorbachev came to New York and he got out of his car and he shook people's hands. And with that move, with that like gesture, stock markets turned around. It was like the bottom of a stock market. And it might have been after the 87 crash. And I just sort of marvel at, I mean, I like yourself, I'm always thinking about these kind of things, like what's going to be the spark? What's going to be the, where's the vulnerabilities? And I think there's so many different places they could be. A reversal on people are positioned in big ways in the treasury market, currencies, a lot of leverage. And I think that's really the takeaway, is that ultimately it's not a bad decision or a bad investment that causes the crisis, but it's too much risk in the system. And this is where I think that Minsky comes in, is just that financial stability itself leads to instability. Stocks only go up, well, let's borrow more money, let's put more money into the stock market.
It's always amazing because out of nowhere, we get these, you know, sometimes they're political. And I can think of last fall when the Fed was giving speeches that QT was on automatic pilot. They were forecasting maybe more interest rate increases for 2019. Oil prices were supposed to rise because of sanctions against Iran. And all of that changed in a period of, 6 weeks? And who knows what could happen politically. And also, Mark, we're also in a presidential election cycle where, you know, you can see some crazy ideas. I mean, just take a look at what just happened to the healthcare sector in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
As a result of, you know, I don't know if you want to call it Medicare for All, Bernie Care, whatever they want to call it. But now you've got healthcare stocks tumbling.
Yeah, no, I guess I agree with you. I think that not a clear outlook for policy, a lot of policy ideas, a presidential cycle. I still think that, you know, here we are 9 years, basically last month, where the economy bottomed from the Great Crisis. And many of my friends, many of my relatives, especially in the Midwest, they don't feel like we've had much of an economic recovery. And here we are, we're sort of suggesting that the recovery might be almost over and sort of lending itself to this financial speculative sort of last phase.
Let's talk about going back to this concept of inflation. You have the lowest unemployment rate in, what, 4 or 5 decades, and you've got wages rising. At what point do those wages, just like material costs, start getting factored into company sales, where companies, as they've said in the first quarter, hey, we're going to have to raise prices?
Yeah, I know. That's concerning a bit, but what I really marvel at is that Throughout the major countries, we have, leaving aside a few pockets like Italy, maybe, we've got very low unemployment levels. And globally, we're not really seeing much wage pressure. So I know when we think about wages, and so I think from like a business point of view, there's another element to wages to figure out what my labor is really costing me. And that is, if wages are going up, can I boost my productivity? And I think that's what the challenge is. So some of the wage increase is absorbed by productivity gains. And so we got to look at like what we call like unit labor costs, and those are still quite mild. So that means to say that this 3.4% year-over-year rise in hourly earnings, a part of it, maybe half of it or so, is being picked up by improvement in productivity. So I guess what I'm saying is that don't look for inflation necessarily from wages, but so it won't necessarily be a push inflation, but companies raising prices to maintain margins because the cost of the product, cost of the inputs is going up.
Given where we are now, we saw the stock market at record levels. It's sort of pulling back at this point, but we did take out previous levels reached last October. Given where the market is, and given the fact, Mark, that you've got a rising dollar right now, and a lot of people don't realize, what is it, about 40% of the S&P 500 sales come from overseas. So a rising dollar hurts corporate profit margins as well. What would you be doing as an investor?
Yeah, I'm scared right now, to tell you the truth. I do see like these things, like you say, low interest rates, a strong dollar, strong stock market. We've had a huge rally. We've had a rally, which I'd say that if you told me at Christmas I could be up 16% by Easter, by the end of April, I'd be happy for that for the whole year. And so I wonder if we're not a little bit exposed to the old adage about sell in May and go away. Maybe we do need some consolidation. I think there's oftentimes this pattern where the companies sort of guide us to have low expectations. They beat the expectations. We rally ahead of this, all this stuff, and then we consolidate and correct afterwards. So I'm a little bit cautious. I have my own personal account. I have taken advantage of rally to lighten up on some stocks, and I'm trying to build up some cash. So when the pullback does come, I'll be emotionally prepared to buy.
You know, it's probably good advice, especially when you have things go out of the blocks. I mean, we had a V-shaped down starting last October, tumbling into the lows of December 4th, and then we've had this V-shaped recovery. And Mark, a lot of the movement in the market has been more on PE multiple expansion than it is anything else. So probably not a bad idea to take some chips off the table. Mark, as we close, if our listeners like to follow the work that you do at Bannockburn Global Forex, how could they do so?
Sure, thanks. I still am able to keep a blog called Mark to Market. That's Mark with a C, marktomarket.com. I update that almost every day, including on the weekends. And also, I'm on Twitter at Mark Making Sense, where I do keep Twitter engaged. So, I appreciate the follows.
All right, Mark, as always, thanks so much for joining us on the program. You have yourself a great weekend.
Good, thank you. Good luck to everybody.
Bye-bye.
And coming up in Hour 2, The Big Picture, Jim Poplava and I discuss the price of oil and gasoline. This week, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced that the waivers granted last November relating to Iranian oil would not be extended beyond May 2nd. Could higher oil prices derail the chances for a second-half recovery that economists are hoping for? Also in Hour 2, politics is causing healthcare to tank and gas prices to break the bank. We discuss why and what investors should do in Hour 2, The Big Picture.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.